Greetings and welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh and our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. And the sun is out today, so I guess probably that's a good omen. It's been pretty gloomy for a while. Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. A nice sunny Friday in April. That's great. After what seemed to be a monsoon of rain. Better than snow, though.
So I think here in the East Coast, you get spoiled. You get teased by the spring weather in February that ruins ski season, and then you get cold, snowy weather in March and April that so you can't ski. But I digress. What do we got this morning?
Our first guest is Deb Pacheco, who's on the board of directors at NAMI and is an author of a book that she's published. Second guest is Robert Cronin, who has been with us before. He's a ward councillor in Newburyport and a candidate for mayor. And,
okay.
And then we had Astrid F. Clintonberg, who's a local attorney.
Okay, that's not what you gave me, this, is it? Yeah, there was something else here. Okay,
that's next week.
I see, okay. Okay, I've got to change that, so I put it up wrong. All right, so I've got to change that, get Robert Cronin back up there on the website. I will do that, so give me the guest again in order, please.
Deb Pacheco is on the board of directors of Mass NAMI, and Bob Cronin is the ward councillor in Newburyport and a candidate for mayor there, and Astrid F. Clintonberg is a local attorney.
All right, I'll make those corrections on our text here on the website. We'll get right to their interviews momentarily.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Roger Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our first guest is Deborah Pacheco. Deb, could you tell us a little bit about your background, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Josh. Hi, my background is in working with special needs children and their families, and what that brought me into working for NAMI and advocating for children who are affected by mental illness. And I have written a book called First Break Schizophrenia, Recovery is Possible, in my pen name, G.J. Monroe. And in the book, I describe the challenges of being a mother of a son who goes through the challenges of his first break with schizophrenia. And through the help of NAMI, he is doing very well today. And so I'd like to talk a lot about that.
Good. And NAMI is the National Alliance of Mental Illness.
Correct. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we have a KPN site here in Gloucester, and there's also the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI Mass.
And tell us about your role on the board of directors for NAMI, and maybe a little bit about what the KPN chapter does.
Sure. NAMI is a program that their mission is to offer support, education, and advocacy for all those struggling with mental health issues, not only for the person struggling, but especially for the family members that are struggling to get them help. NAMI KPN has trained me to be a support group facilitator where people usually come when they're in crisis mode, when something's happening with their loved one, they know they're sick, but they don't know where to turn or what to do. So we offer the support group for that. We also offer a family-to-family class in the fall, and that really teaches loved ones about the illness, about how it's a brain disorder, and about how to get help for their loved ones and also maintain their health in doing it all.
Great. And so you have your own situation and experience with your son. Can you tell us a little bit that story? And I know it motivated you to write a book. Kind of blend the two together and just tell us your story, I guess.
Sure. Back in, it was on 9/11, the day that affected most people in this country, my son was 19. He was away at college. He is very, very late. And he's tutoring upperclassmen. He's a freshman tutoring upperclassmen in physics. He was a physics major. And I didn't know it, but that was the day when things kind of started going for him. I didn't know it until he came home Christmas time that he seemed different. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know why, how he had changed or what it was all about, but I knew he had changed. And I thought maybe he was on drugs or maybe the stress of school. I didn't really know what was going on. But as he went back to school for the second semester, that winter, spring semester, I got a phone call in January of 2002 asking me to come and get him, telling me that there were the people at school were aliens who had put implants in his head and chest, and that they were keeping him there against his will. So not knowing what to think, I got in my car and drove out to Western Mass to pick him up, and not knowing what to do or how to get him help, I brought him home, and I did things that I know now I shouldn't have done, because when we got home, he seemed better, so I started bargaining with him. Well, I won't make him go to the emergency room until after. He wanted to go see the Patriots parade. They had just won. So I did a lot of bargaining with him that I learned now that did not help him. Because by the time it was time to get him to the emergency room and to go get help, he was now pretty much out of control, punching holes, and we had to get to the police to come in and help me to get him there. And one of the first things you think of is, oh, you're the embarrassment that the police were there. But then you think, no, the most important thing is getting your son treatment and help. And as I got support from NAMI, I learned, and I learned more and more about how to get the treatment that he needed. So the first time, he had three hospitalizations within 3 months, even at McLean's, and they sent him home on medication. And we kept trying within those 3 months to get him help. And unfortunately, nothing really helped, and the mental health system had failed him at that point. And in a cold May rainy day, he was up on the API at Andrew Bridge, seeing delusions, thinking he was God and that he was had to fight the devil. And he thought he was going to ascend when he went off the bridge and fight the devil, but he landed 80 feet into the dirt and sustained quite a lot of injuries from that fall. He broke his everything in his left foot, and he had to use only his upper body strength to pull himself up on top of the bridge for help. And it was quite amazing that he was able to do that. From there, it became a physical illness where he was admitted with his physical injuries. And at that point, you see the difference between the support you get with somebody with a physical illness and the support you get from somebody with just quote-unquote, a mental illness. The cards, the letters, the casseroles started pouring in, and now he was being treated physically, and you saw the difference. While he was in the hospital, they did find the right medicine for him at that time, and I did sort of have my son back, but it took a full year for him to learn to go through the surgeries and for him to learn to walk again on a prosthetic leg and to get better from his physical injuries, while it took 5 years of me fighting the mental health system to finally get him the right medicine that he needed for his schizophrenia to be treated. And that help came from NAMI, and that is what I'm so thankful for. He got his help in 2007, and today he's 34. He's 34 years old. His physical limitations are difficult because his legs are so badly damaged, but he now leads a support group at NAMI for other peers who are going through severe mental health issues like schizophrenia or bipolar or OCD. And he has come a long way, thanks to NAMI, in his recovery.
Great. And you've written a book about schizophrenia. And tell us about that.
Yep. It's called First Break Schizophrenia, Recovery is Possible. It's written in my pen name, DJ Monroe. There's a foreword in here by a doctor from McLean, and it is Dr. Deb Levy. She works at McLean, and she talks about how what our story is not that much different than so many other families that go through the tragedy of schizophrenia. And a lot of it is working on getting the treatment that they need, which is very hard to do. It's very hard to get treatment in this country. And that is where NAMI comes in, and NAMI helps with the support that the loved ones need to help them get the treatment that they need. Most people with schizophrenia are not even aware that they're sick. A lot of people that are experiencing mania and bipolar are not aware that they're sick. And what the loved ones go through, watching the behaviors of their loved ones until they get the help they need, is very difficult. And that's what I talk about in the book.
Is it also true that there are lots of issues with medication? People trying to find the right medication for the right person, and that, you know, there's no one medicine that works for everybody. It's you know, kind of touch and feel your way around, and my understanding is that whether it's bipolar, or at least in bipolar and some other mental challenges, that the side effects are such that it compels people to weigh whether or not they are going to take it, or they'll be almost a desire to go off the medicine because somebody doesn't like the weight gain, somebody doesn't like how sleepy, or they feel like they're walking around like a zombie, or there are other kinds of issues that impact them. Am I right along that line?
Yes, finding the right medication is probably the hardest part in getting the right treatment. For some people, once they've stabilized and they are on the right treatment, some are at a point where they can go off medications and find other sources of treatment. But in my experience, what I've seen is finding the right medication is the most important thing. For my son, when he was not, in those 5 years when he was not properly medicated, he needed cigarettes. The nicotine was what helped him the most. So what happens is when they're not on the right medications, they self-medicate, whether it's from cigarettes or alcohol or marijuana or worse. They are self-medicating, and that's one of the risks of untreated or improperly treated mental illness. One of the first risks is school failure. We have a lot of children that are in school that aren't identified and aren't treated, and there's many more than people think. About 1 in 5 children are experiencing a mental illness while in school, and only 1 out of those 5 are actually getting any treatment for it. So school failure is one of the first signs of a mental illness.
And some of the diagnoses are not easily obtained because the child needs to age to a certain level before you can be certain that it's this or it's that, correct?
True. We are seeing children younger and younger. One of the biggest ones in school right now is generalized anxiety disorder. We're seeing a lot of school phobia, kids having so much anxiety that they're not even able to get up and go to school, the depression. We see a lot of mood disorder, which comes out as children's behaviors. And these are all risks that if they're not getting the right treatment, part of the right treatment is their IEP, getting the correct IEP, getting the right services through the school, and also the right placement that they're getting in the right school to go to so that they are being dealt with properly. So school failure is a huge risk. Substance abuse is a huge risk. And another huge risk of not getting the right treatment is life failure, which a lot of people, it happens so much that there's court involvement for these people before they get the right treatment. It's sad. Or homelessness, or the last risk would be hurting themselves or someone else. But only 1% of those afflicted with a mental illness are going to hurt somebody else. And it's sad, the stigma that's in society right now and on the media that shows schizophrenia is hurting other people or people with mental illness hurting other people. that's the stigma. So we're working really hard to change the stigma. What we know is that people with brain disorders are our most intelligent, creative, and talented people that have ever lived. If you think of a famous artist, a famous painter, a famous actor, a genius, most of them have suffered with a mental illness. And this is why people need treatment, because they have valuable gifts to offer, and they need the treatment. It's very, very important.
Okay, tell us a little more about the book.
So in the book, I talk about how, you know, we start from the 9/11. We talk about what happened that day, talk about, what it was like for us home, what it was like for Aaron that day. Very confused. He started his breakdown. And then the long recovery of going out to Western Mass, bringing him home, trying to get him the help he needed, and thinking he's stable, and all the hospitalizations. And then, of course, his what happened to him very tragically before he even got his diagnosis was when he survived the 80-foot jump off the Gloucester Bridge.
And when he was away at school, did the maybe at the college or university, did they have any insight as to what was happening? Or,
well, one of the other issues with mental health is that your child is not your child; they're an adult when they're away at college.
Yeah.
And so, one of the things that's very hard to deal with is the HIPAA laws. They work against people with mental illness. I was not allowed to sign my son in from the mental health treatment they needed. But after he had his injuries on the bridge, I was the one asked to sign to have his leg amputated. So you see what happens here with the HIPAA laws. They're not consistent, and they really need to be changed so that the family members can have much more of a part in helping get the treatment for people suffering from mental illness.
You typically wouldn't think to have a health proxy at that time. It's usually something. I mean, you go into the hospital or a doctor, and they'll say, "Do you have a health proxy?" And you say, "No, I don't need that," or whatever. But until you get to a certain age, and then it becomes more appropriate. So you don't think there's a need for that. And you know, the younger people are, there's not. You just would have anticipate that this could just come upon you when you'd have to deal with it.
Right. The thing for when you're working with children trying to get treatment, the parents still have the ability to get them the treatment. But as soon as that child turns 18, you no longer have the say in it. But in NAMI, we teach in our support groups about having your loved one, when they're at a healthy point, sign a 2A consent form so that they are understanding that there are going to be times when they may not be able to make the best decision for themselves. And so they'll sign so that you can be part of that decision making. And it can be a little tricky because you're dealing with adults now, and that's part of the problem for getting treatment.
What about the, you mentioned in the context of some of your prior comments that helping the families who have the child or family member who has an affliction with a person with a mental illness, what kind of support is there for that, and how much how much does it take sometimes to help them understand what the illness or the challenge involves and what to look out for? And you know, is there a respite opportunity for them? And how does that play out?
Well, there are three stages that we see in when your child, because it's an onset. Your child isn't born with a mental illness. So your child has this onset. And for my son, it was at 19. I never thought I was going to have any problems with my son. He was so intelligent. I thought he was just going to go on to have a wonderful career. So when the first initial reaction is denial.
Sure.
You know, you don't want to believe that this is really happening to your loved one. So your body kind of goes into denial and starts to make excuses for all the behaviors or like I first thought he was getting into drugs or something was going on at school. Typically, people will see their child spend more and more time in their room, away from other people. So for the family, it's very, very upsetting. You're seeing a big, huge change in your loved one, and you don't know how to get them the help. You don't know how to address it with them. They, in many cases, they don't even know that they're sick. So they're just telling you, I'm not sick, leave me alone. So when you come to a NAMI support group, these are all people that are going with, that have been through or are going through what you have been through. And they understand that it is a crisis that you're going through, that it's a catastrophe, just like a 9/11 in your own personal household. And you have to be able to get through it. And you go from the denial, and then the next stage, you start to accept it. You start to kind of get some NAMI support, and you start to learn some things about it, and then you start to deal with it. And then the third phase is advocacy. But during the times when you have your loved one backslide or go through another episode, the family member is right back at stage one again. So it's not like you get through these stages and then you're all better either. It's coping. It's very much a family illness. And I have to say this, in my last family to family class, we came up with the word for us family members, and it was endurance. And we thought that was a very great word for what the families go through. And one of the women brought in a cake with endurance on it, which really sums up what it's like for the parent, for the loved ones.
Great. Very well. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. What else can you share with us about the book and about?
Sure. I can tell you a little bit about what NAMI KPN is doing now. We are working hand in hand with Linda Cottrell, who is an artist, and she's a former president of NAMI Mass, and she was also on the board of directors of NAMI National. And she has created this amazing, it's called 99 Faces. What it is it's beautiful, beautiful life-size portraits, 33 faces of people living with schizophrenia, 33 faces of people living with bipolar, and 33 faces of people who love them. And it's such a great anti-stigma about brain disorders, because when you look at the beautiful faces, you can't tell who is suffering or who is a loved one. And this is going to be presented. She has a beautiful presentation set to music about, you know, sort of your loved one looking for answers, looking for help, and it's set to the music, I Will Fix You by Coldplay. And then it kind of turns around, and they show pictures of the loved ones together laughing and having fun, and it's set to a more upbeat song. And it's just a wonderful presentation about anti-stigma and to help people understand more about the faces of mental health. And we are actually having our annual meeting at the NAMI office here in Gloucester on Tuesday, April 18th. And we are going to have a very moving presentation of 99 Faces during that annual meeting, and everyone is invited. And then the Museum of Science is going to be having this show, and it's starting the end of May, and it's going to be there throughout the summer, where people will go and they'll learn scientifically about the brain and how the brain is affected when people are affected.
Deb,
with different mental illnesses.
This is Rick Moore. I'm a co-host with Josh. Good morning, and thank you for sharing this. This is powerful stuff. And in my experience, language, and I know we're getting short on time, but language means so much. And I have come across revulsion and repulsion when people use the word mental illness or your mental, that kind of thing. However, when you talk about brain disorder or mental health, you get a different reaction. Is that common? I mean, I get that response, but is that common?
Yes, we're trying to change it to speaking about mental health, because we truly all are on a spectrum of mental health. People say, oh, I had to take a mental health day. You know, we kind of get stressed in our day-to-day life. All of us experience some levels of anxiety and depression, but when you talk about clinical aspects of anxiety and depression, people don't really understand it until they've lived with it themselves or through a loved one. But we really do want to break that schizophrenics being violent or, you know, the people out on the streets, because those are truly people who did not get the treatment that they needed. And that's what we're talking about. Untreated mental illness is what people see, not mental health, which is what we want people to see.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me, just in closing, can you tell us if people want to follow up with the Cape Ann chapter of NAMI, who would they contact, how would they do that, and where can they pick up your book?
Yep, I'm on Amazon. The bookstore downtown also has a few copies, and namicapeann.org will tell you everything about us, and we're right on 43 Gloucester Ave, and
great.
Everybody's welcome to come on Tuesday evenings.
Great. Thank you very much and for being a guest on our program, Trending Now with Josh Hannell.
Thank you so much. It's been
take
a pleasure.
Care. All right. Take care. Bye now.
Take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our guest is Robert Cronin, who's a city councilor in Newburyport and a candidate for mayor, has been on some of our MSO radio shows in the past. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you, Josh. Great to be back.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had an uncle named Robert Cronin who was head of the detectives of the Gloucester Police Force a million years ago, and so it's I always see a name, I think of my uncle, but anyway, tell us a little bit about your background, and then we can talk about some politics stuff.
Sure. Kind of like your uncle, I was in law enforcement 33 years. I worked for the Andover Police Department and retired from the Middlesex Sheriff's Office. Running their, for lack of a better term, their detective division.
Wow.
And
go ahead.
And doing some consulting work on the side right now. And I've been a four-term city councilor and made the decision that I'm going to take the next step and offer my candidacy for mayor.
Right, and your election is this year?
Yes, in November.
In November.
There may be a primary, which would be in September, if there are, you know, three or more people that return papers.
Okay, and there is an incumbent mayor, and I assume that that person will be running again, or?
I would assume that the mayor would be running again. She, as of yet, hasn't pulled her papers. I think she has indicated that she is going to run. There is one other person that did pull papers, and I'm unsure if they're returned yet, but I anticipate they will be.
So tell us about the issues in Newburyport now, and what are some of the things that drove you to say, I need to go beyond the legislative branch and get involved in the executive branch. And what was some of the thinking that's gone on there?
Sure. You know, first and I don't want to say foremost, but you know, our central waterfront has been a an issue of concern and a talking point for probably the last 50 years. We're at the point now where we have a proposed parking garage where we can take some parking off the waterfront and move it to the garage and hopefully make parklands out of the dirt parking lots on the water. And this has been going on, like I said, for years and years and years, and it's time that this gets accomplished. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is, and you have to excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm
going
to go to here, is fiscal responsibility. We've done a lot of projects in the last 7 years, and those projects have been arguably just snapshots, and we have not really taken a look at the entire community as a complete picture. And I think that that's really, really important moving forward of how Project A or Project B affects our schools, our infrastructure, our roads, our water, our sewer, our public safety services. So I think that we have to take a stronger look at that. We have to look at our zoning and where we want to go and what we want to be as a community.
What kind of changes in zoning do you think are likely to be part of the discussion going forward in terms of resolving any outstanding issues in Newburyport?
Well, I think one of the higher end topics is infill. We have an awful lot of historic homes, especially in our north and south end, which is, you know, the perimeter around our historic downtown. And a lot of these are being chipped away at either by splitting lots into two or making half houses out of captain's houses and whatnot. And it goes back to what I've said before, which is how does it affect our infrastructure? And like it or not, right now we are an automobile-based community, and parking in some of the neighborhoods is a real issue. And we're taking a lot of on-street parking away when we're creating curb cuts for these new houses. So, you know, that's one thing that we have to take a real strong, hard look at. Along with that, our schools, which we just built a brand new elementary school. And
they're not cheap anymore. Not that they were ever cheap, but the kinds of requirements that if you become involved with state financing and what used to be the School Building Assistance Bureau, because the standards continue to upgrade every 5 or 10 years, it's a much more expensive proposition to build an elementary school these days.
Correct. We just built an elementary school. The cost of it was about $34 million.
Yeah.
We rehabbed our what we call our upper middle school and upper elementary school and middle school. It's a combination for $28 million, and that was 2 years ago. And we're at the bursting point right now, so that's where we have to look at some of these projects and see how it affects our schools. We have a lot of projects coming forward that we have to take a real hard look at.
How many schools are there in Newburyport?
Three schools right now. There's an elementary school, which is K, is pre-K through three, a shared school, a shared building, with an upper elementary school of 4, 5, and 6 connected to the middle school, and then, of course, we have the high school.
Good. And of course, the more people come in there, the more development you have, the greater the impact, not only on schools but on police, on fire. So there's those build out propositions. I know in New Hampshire that there are. There are communities that charge an impact fee. So when a developer's coming in and putting in 40 condominiums or 40 units of housing, the permitting process is such that they have to pay a higher level, and those impact fees go into like a savings account, for lack of a better term, that then are used by the municipality to drive, what impact cost those additional people bring to a community, whether it's additional street lighting, additional firefighters, additional law enforcement, et cetera. Is anything like that something that folks in Newburyport have thought about, discussed at any point?
I have thought about this. We aren't doing anything at that level right now.
Okay.
We certainly should be looking at developer contributions. I don't know if Massachusetts can actually charge an impact fee, but we should be looking at infrastructure upgrades for all special permits that are being issued, or any variance in zoning bylaws or zoning ordinances that could be issued. And just circling back to the schools for one heartbeat, we just got rid of school choice because we don't have enough room to bring kids in from other districts, which we were dependent upon in the last decade or so for another source of revenue.
So that impacts you as well. School choice is a funny thing. We had actually the former commissioner of education on our program just a couple of weeks ago, and school choice and so forth came up. But getting in, a few more minutes left, Bob. What are the key issues on the waterfront that you would want to address in your administration if you were mayor?
Well, we want to get parking off the waterfront and create green space and park space and connect our two rail trail systems through that park space in the downtown. So that would be my goal. Right now we have several entities down there. We have obviously the City of Newburyport, our sub-park, which is the Harbor Commission and the Harbor Master. We also have the Newburyport Redevelopment Authority, which is arguably a quasi-state agency. And we have another group called the Waterfront Trust, which is a trust that we set up to preserve open space in the water in our downtown. And I want to eliminate the NRA as soon as possible and get the Waterfront Trust more involved so they can act as stewards of the open water, of the open waterfront. It's kind of like with the Stage Point Park in Gloucester, which is, it's a destination. People go there to picnic, to look at the boats, to look at the views, and that's what we want here in Newburyport as well.
In the bureaucracy associated with making changes along the waterfront, is it difficult in Newburyport as it seems to be in Gloucester?
Yes, it is difficult because you have many agencies tugging for the same purse strings. The Newburyport Redevelopment Authority did a yeoman's job in the 60s and 70s saving historic Newburyport from becoming just strip malls.
Yeah.
And
they also took advantage of a lot of the federal money that was around, whether it's the block grant or community development money, to refurbish and build up or restore parts of Newburyport, much more so than some of the other cities on the North Shore have done.
Oh, absolutely. Back in the day, I truly believe that we were the the poster. We were the example for good, you know, urban renewal and development. The NRA has exceeded its lifetime, exceeded its mandate. We just have a couple of parcels that are open, and like I said, they're dirt parking lots right now. And we just want to, you know, I don't want to compare them to another community north of us.
Yeah.
We really do need closure on this to make this, you know, the final, you know, jewel in the crown of Newburyport.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, sharing with us your thoughts on managing the city of Newburyport, and we certainly wish you well in your upcoming campaign. Maybe we can have you back on later as the campaign gets underway and we know what the field looks like.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to do it.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender. MSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders. Mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our next guest is a resident of Gloucester, Astrid Clintonburg. Astrid, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Josh.
Tell us, we ask folks, tell us a little bit about yourself, your bio, background, and so forth, and then talk about some of the work you do as a local attorney.
I am a Gloucesterite, born and bred, went through the Gloucester public school system, went off to Ripon College for 2 years, dropped out, got married, got divorced, went back to school, then went finished off my degree at UMass Boston, and then went on to Northeastern University School of Law. And I've been practicing as an attorney ever since.
Wow.
That was 1998. So I do criminal defense work. I started out... I actually started out working for a Boston attorney, Elliot Weinstein, for a few years, and then went out on my own and did what's called bar advocate work. So I've essentially been a public defender my entire career. So I'm now a staff attorney with the Committee for Public Counsel Services in Malden, and so I cover the Malden, Cambridge, and Somerville courts.
Tell us about what's involved in being a public defender, from the caseload to the types of cases, and some of the issues that you find yourself contending with.
Sure. So my practice really hasn't changed. When I first went out on my own, I was in private practice, but the vast majority of my caseload was appointed work. Massachusetts has sort of this dual system where we have staff attorneys, public defenders, which is what I am now, and then but the vast majority of the cases are handled very ably, I might add, by bar advocates. And those are attorneys who are in private practice and who have a percentage, usually it's a pretty high percentage, of criminal defense work. And then they just bill the state. And so what happens for in both cases, whether you're a bar advocate or a staff attorney, you're assigned duty days, and you go into a court, a various, whatever court you're assigned to that day, and if you're the only person on, you take every case that comes in. If you're there with another attorney or two other attorneys, you share the caseload. And that means you could come, and I'm in the district court, so it means you could get anything from, you know, any case where somebody could potentially go to jail, that person is entitled to an attorney. Not a free attorney, a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, but for $150, that does not go to the attorney, it just goes into the general slush fund. They get an attorney. And then we just work those cases. My caseload sort of goes up and down, and it can be anywhere from mid-30s to, I've had as much as, actually when I was a bar advocate, I was up to about 80 cases one time. That's way, way, way too much, because you're the attorney, you're the person working that case. And, you know, you do what the case needs. Some cases are very simple and straightforward, so case numbers are a little bit of a red herring, because I could have 30 cases, but each one of those clients could be involve quite a bit of work, whether it's in motion practice, whether it's in trying to find programs for that client. I have gotten to be kind of known for working well and eagerly with people with mental health issues. So those clients also have a whole host of problems as well, where, you know, are they even competent? Because of their mental illness or intellectual disability? I've actually have several clients who are DDS clients as well. And so I have to work with them and really make sure that person, my client, is understanding the process and is able to work with me, not just knowing who all the players are, but is able to rationally assist me. And that's sort of a technical term. But it essentially means that they know what's going on, and their decision-making process is not tainted by either an intellectual disability or maybe a mental health issue, whether it's psychosis or maybe elevated mood, like what some people would describe as bipolar. So that's what I do. I take my I love my job. I have the best job in the entire world. I have great support with CPCS. I have fabulous colleagues. But when I was a bar advocate, I loved my job too. I did a little bit more variety of work at that time. I was on several panels, so I did appellate work. I was in the district court, the juvenile courts. I also did what are called Mary Moe petitions. So those are judicial bypass. So if a girl who is under the age of 18 wants to get an abortion, she has to go, without her parents' permission, she has to go through a judicial process, and I would be assigned to represent her through that process. So now all I'm doing is essentially district court work, but throughout my career, I've been really just so lucky to be able to serve clients who are indigent, who are poor. That's a real thrill for me.
How do you deal with the investigatory or probing of things? You're a staff of one, I assume. You're the sole attorney on a case, and yet you have to go back and look at the details or reenact the crime or process and interview people and so forth. What does that involve for you, and how difficult is that to do in balance against the rest of the cases that you have?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. So there is, as a bar advocate and now as a staff attorney, I have always used private investigators, independent investigators. The prosecution has a whole fleet of investigators. They're called the police.
Right.
And so we are allowed to, we're, as a bar advocate, I would seek funds, court funds, to hire a private investigator. It's tricky, and every once in a while in the press it gets to be this whole thing about, oh, these public defenders are spending so much money. Well, they never look at the police cost, because those are their private investigators. So we'll get money, and I'll have an investigator go out and talk to witnesses. Sometimes they'll, take pictures, that kind of thing. I've been lucky that I've built up relationships with a couple of really great private investigators over the years who I work well with. And it's to the point now where even as a staff attorney, and I have access to a public, we have a staff private investigator who services the about 10 attorneys that we have in our office. So sometimes he'll get booked up, and if I need something quick, I can go back to the two investigators that I've had in the past. And, because we've worked over the years so long, I can just say, okay, I need you to do this, this, and this, and they know exactly what to do. One of the things that people make is they think that appointed attorneys, across the board are terrible or whatever. In Massachusetts has probably one of the best public defender, or appointed counsel systems in the country. And frankly, it is not because we're paid a lot. We're actually, Massachusetts bar advocates and staff attorneys are paid at, close to the bottom, especially when you take into account how much it costs to live in Massachusetts.
Mm.
But because it is such, the organizations, the bar advocate organizations and CPCS really have that, the ethic, the mission of zealous advocacy and also, client-centered advocacy. Everybody hates, quote-unquote, criminals. I don't represent criminals. I have clients. I have, Tom, Dick, Harry, Jane, June, and Josephine in front of me. Those are the people who I represent, the individuals. And everybody has a story. And it's my job to tell the story to a fact finder, ultimately, maybe, or to a court if we decide to resolve the case short of trial.
How do you develop? I'm just going to take that for a minute because, how do you... how do you take when you're listening to the client's story?
Mm-hmm.
How do you develop? A sense of they're lying through their teeth, or they're telling the truth, or they really believe it, but that's probably not what happened. I mean, how do you differentiate, and how important is it for you to differentiate in the context of your ability to make sure they get a fair trial and to defend them?
So I'll answer that with what my cocktail party response always is, because somebody will find out what I do and they'll say, how can you represent those guilty scumbags? And I always come back with the statement that my client may or may not have engaged in conduct which may or may not rise to the level of a criminal offense. What is a crime? I go in and talk to schools and colleges every once in a while, somebody will say, how can you, somebody who's charged with it, they must have done it. And then I always come up and I hit them with a crumpled up piece of paper. And I will say, I have just potentially committed assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Because that's all it is. Assault and battery with a dangerous weapon sounds really, really serious. I've represented people where the dangerous weapon was a paperclip, a pixie stick. I have seen, it was not my case, however, I have seen assaults with a dangerous weapon, to wit, a snowball. So that can be charged. So just keep that in mind. When I talk to a client, part of my process is, as an educator, I have to say, okay, you know, you have this kind of record, so I assume you know that, you know, I could say, I assume you know the system, but I can't. I have to satisfy myself that this person understands the process, so it means doing a little mini class in, these are your rights under the criminal justice system in the United States of America. And then also going over them what they're charged with and making sure they understand what they're charged with, and making sure they understand what each element of the crime or crimes that they're charged with requires. So, you know, trespass is just is being someplace where you weren't supposed to be after you were either given notice or told to leave and you remained. People have this idea, oh, I know what assault means. Well, actually, assault doesn't mean hitting somebody. Assault means putting somebody in fear of an unwanted touching.
Yeah.
So that's a long way of saying, my job is more to give that client initially information. Then we'll go over what happened. And each time it's different.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and I am more often than not telling clients who just say, oh, well, I just want to plead guilty because I did it. And then we'll talk about what actually happened. I'll say, well, you know, you did something. But what I'm seeing right here, right now, the Commonwealth can't prove their case. And so what do you want to do? Ultimately, my client is my boss. I have to do what he or she says. But it really is, you know, if I'm doing my job right, it's a good partnership.
Right.
And it's, you know, trying to make sure they understand what all is involved. There are times when people say, well, how could I have, you know, how could this be malicious destruction of property? You know, I was ranging around and I broke the window, but, you know, it was an accident. Well, but you were ranging around, you were drunk, you knew that, you know, you were acting recklessly. That can be malicious, and you broke the guy's window or his mirror or his whatever. So, yeah, that can be malicious destruction. So it really is, because so much, you know, we have these crimes, which are really definitions. We have these crimes, and you have to see, okay, is what the Commonwealth is saying happened and what they're going to be able to prove happened, does that fall into the definition of that crime?
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't even make it by a mile. Sometimes it's a toss-up. Sometimes it's one of those things where you're saying, you know, we have this quote-unquote come-to-Jesus conversation with our client saying, yeah, I know you really feel like you were wrong. Unfortunately, with what they're charging here and what, you know, the Commonwealth is likely going to be able to prevail, how do you want to proceed? My client says, I still want to go to trial, I want to get my story across. Fine. I go home. You know, that's not my deal. My deal is to give that person as much information and pay them the respect of, you know, of really listening to them. And that's, you know, that's an important part of my job.
Great. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh. I know time flies, and there's so much more we could talk about. So maybe we can have you back another time and talk about some political issues.
Sure thing. Never ask a lawyer. Don't give us an open-ended question. We'll take it, Josh, every time.
All right, Esther. Sure, thank you. All right. Bye now. Thank you.
Bye.
Another one of my former students, but she wouldn't remember that. That was a long time ago.
Okay.
All right, so what are some of our future topics here?
We have Susan Gilbert Lee, the executive director of Rocky Neck Art Colony, is going to be a guest next week. And then we have several other people I'm waiting to get back to us for April and May, and should be continue to be a good group of people that I think our listening audience is going to enjoy.
I read somewhere where the Rocky Neck Art Colony is the oldest working colony, art colony in the country. It was one of the earliest formed and still in operation.
I believe that's the case.
Cool. All right, that's Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky, and the sun is out. Go enjoy.